From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Malcolm Turnbull's memoir was much anticipated. Even so, it's landed with additional fanfare. This is thanks to copies being distributed ahead of publication by Scott Morrison's staffer, who's been threatened with legal action by the book's publisher and has since apologised. The huge tome covers Turnbull's event-filled life before politics. But most interest is in his parliamentary years, which included losing the leadership in both opposition and government. In each case, while the reasons for his downfall were multiple, his fight for more action on climate change was central. In his book, Turnbull is frank about his former political colleagues, including Scott Morrison, whom he both praises and damns. Within the Liberal Party, Turnbull has always been a controversial character. For his supporters, he's a small-L liberal progressive who stood up for the right causes. For his detractors, he's a Labour man in big L liberal clothing who has undermined the party. Feelings haven't changed since he left politics. Malcolm Turnbull joins us today, remotely, of course. Malcolm Turnbull, firstly about the leak of your book, your publishers have threatened to take legal action against the Morrison staffer concerned. Will this action go ahead?
Well, that's really a matter for them, Michelle. It's a very big issue in the publishing industry, as you know, and all of the creative industries, internet, copyright piracy is a crime. I mean, if you... distribute pirated copies of a book or a film or a song, you're stealing, just as if you're, shoplifting from Dimex. So it is a serious matter. For them it is really a big issue of principle, but I'm leaving that to them. Obviously it's rather awkward timing, given that the government's out there in the press today talking about how it's going to take steps to ensure that Facebook and Google pay money to newspapers for the use of their content, and talking up the sanctity of copyright, and at the same time someone in the Prime Minister's office is distributing, as he's admitted, at least 59 copies of the book in breach of copyright.
Now, just on this question of the timing of the book's release, the timing is somewhat difficult. How does one do a virtual book tour? What are you doing exactly?
Just like this, I'm doing a lot of Zoom meetings, large and small, and podcasts like yours. And so I'm doing all this from home. With occasional excursions to studios, like at the ABC last week, where we recorded an interview with between Lee Sales and myself, and in a vast hall with everybody meters apart. So it was a rather unusual environment, but that's what you have to do.
Now, just to get to the substance, you document in the book your battles over climate change, which ended in personal disaster for you, not just on one occasion, but twice. Looking back, do you think you could have done things any differently to have achieved more success on that issue and at less personal cost?
Well, if you look back at what I did in 2018, you can see that I was very consciously learning from the experiences of 2009. So I was very careful to keep the cabinet together. I consulted the party room very carefully. The National Energy Guarantee was, had the widest support of any energy policy I can recall. And no one could have said I was high-handed or, heavy-handed. I was very, very consultative, and it clearly had the support of a substantial majority in the party room. But that did not stop a minority basically using it as a means of destabilising the government, both to get their own way on climate and also to undermine my leadership. And this was all part of the you know, the Dutton coup, which ended much to their dismay in Scott Morrison becoming Prime Minister.
So where do you see Australia's policy on climate going from here? There's been speculation, of course, that the bushfires might have been a game changer, but is that really likely? And on the other side, of course, the coronavirus has had the effect of bringing a short-term hit to emissions. But what about the longer term?
Well, the obstacle to effective action on climate change in Australia is entirely political. The community, the business community, you know, civil society are by and large united in their determination to move to a zero emission energy sector and a net zero emission economy. However, there is a determined minority. I think it's still a minority, although it may become a majority, depending on how far the Liberal Party moves to the right. But there is a determined minority within the Liberal Party and the National Party, supported by, obviously, the fossil fuel lobby, but above all by the right-wing media, in particular Murdoch's media, which has resolutely opposed taking action on climate change. And so, you know, as I record in the book, we had during December and January, during these terrible fires, you know, we'd have on one page of the News Limited tabloids, you know, pictures of the most terrible destruction, and facing them, you know, attacks on Greta Thunberg or anybody else that takes climate change seriously. So that is the roadblock. You remember back in 2007 when both John Howard and Kevin Rudd were supporting an emissions trading scheme. You know, that was a bipartisan policy. Well, Abbott weaponized climate change as an issue. He was backed in by elements in the media, and we are where we are. So I think it's absent a change inside the coalition, I don't think we'll get any progress on this anytime soon. Now, you know, one of the disappointments I've had with the Morrison government is that Scott did not take the opportunity after his miraculous win in May to reinstate the NEG. Because Scott believes in it. I mean, he absolutely was on board with it, as was Josh. I mean, it was not, you know, it was absolutely a joint effort. They've got as much, you know, handiwork in it as I have. in Josh's case, possibly a bit more. But you know, so at that moment when his political capital was, as you'd agree, you know, at its absolute zenith, he still wasn't prepared to do it because he knows that right-wing group in the party room would, if they got the chance, do the same to him as they did to me.
Well, just talking about that group, it is a minority, I would have thought. Surely most of the Liberal MPs are pretty pragmatic. When you became Prime Minister, did you think initially that the party would settle down after the coup, or did you in fact underestimate the determination of your opponents?
Yeah, calculated or considered the possibility that there would be a group within the party that would seek to destroy the government and cause us to go into opposition. But, you know, that was Abbott's agenda. And as Rupert Murdoch has admitted in his discussion with me in that coup week, that was Paul Whitaker's agenda. Paul Bill Boris, as he's better known, is the most senior editorial executive of News Corp in Australia, very close to Lachlan. And they had this crazy agenda to bring down my government in the expectation this would result in Shorten winning an election so that Abbott could come back as opposition leader after the election. I mean, it's completely crazy, but that, you know, that's why so many people said at the time, and you know, they're identified and quoted in the book, that the right's concern was not that I'd lose the election, but that I'd win it. Now, you know, it's trying to provide a rational analysis of that is very difficult. I mean, you've been around politics for longer than me, Michelle. I've never seen anything as mad as that. But there it is. You know, that was their agenda.
Looking back or reading back over those years in your book, one is struck by the fact that there was a lot of bad behaviour by a number of people. How much responsibility do you yourself take for some of that bad behaviour?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, I take responsibility for my own behaviour, but I can't take responsibility for others.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of undermining of people by others, by their colleagues.
By whom? Who are we talking about?
Well, I think a number of the leading characters in the book, and surely you would agree that you were part of the manoeuvrings of those years, sometimes to your advantage, sometimes to your disadvantage.
You're being uncharacteristically obscure, Michelle, but let's look at Abbott. I mean, Abbott's government's problems were created by Abbott and Credlaw, not by me. In fact, as I describe in the book in some detail, there are a number of messes that Abbott got himself into that I ended up sorting out, whether it was the citizenship deprivation fiasco, which was, or you remember the metadata fiasco. Basically, Abbott kept on making knee-jerk decisions without proper preparation, without proper consultation with the predictable consequences. And on a number of occasions, I basically cleaned them up, for which I got scant thanks, or no thanks, of course. look at the fiasco over gay marriage. I mean, what an extraordinary shambles that was. Any normal government, Abbott had said to the party room, when Enchi raised it in the party room, he said, look, we'll take it to leadership group and then cabinet will consider it and we'll come back to the party room. And everyone thought, oh, well, that makes sense. That's what you'd normally do. Instead, we had this sudden party room meeting called and everyone is invited to stand up and give, extemporized speeches about what they think should be done. And it was a complete bedlam. I've never seen anything crazier than that. And, so that did him a lot of damage, but that was his doing. I didn't tell him to make Prince Philip a knight. I didn't tell him to give Simon Benson the outcome of the cabinet meeting before it was held on citizenship. What a joke that was. Benson had a story the morning after the cabinet meeting saying, last night the cabinet decided X, Y, Z. Well, the cabinet hadn't actually, but he'd been briefed by Abbott's office before the meeting. How ludicrous.
A lot of what you write, of course, is very close up and personal to conversations and interactions between the various players. When you were writing, did you worry about breaking confidences? How did you navigate that line?
Well, it's really just a question of judgment, Michelle. There's a question. You can't write a political memoir without talking about what actually happened. And so you do need to, you have to, every diarist, every memoirist, if that's the right term, has to talk about discussions and events. It wouldn't be much of a history if I hadn't done that. But I have obviously used my discretion and there are things that, naturally have been said that have not been repeated. But, I think if you were to look, particularly someone like yourself that has been in the press gallery for a long time. I know there have been people saying, oh, it's terrible to describe, Scott Morrison's front running on tax policy and that was a problem for the government. Everyone in the gallery knew that. The setting it out in the way I did maybe will be of interest to many people, no doubt, but it's a fact and hardly a surprise. You understood that. It was obvious. It was a subject of public commentary at the time.
Now, you obviously kept a diary of key events. Did you keep that diary all through?
Yeah, I did intermittently. I didn't keep it every day, but I did keep. Yeah, I did keep contemporaneous records. I wish I'd kept more. Because it's quite interesting when you're writing a book and you go back, you'll see in your diary accounts of an event that absent the diary, you have very little recollection of. Mm. Now, memory is very frail. And so there are, you know, obviously the episodes that I can most effectively and indeed colourfully recount are those that I've got contemporary records for.
It's not quite as comprehensive as that of the former Labor minister, one-time Labor minister, the late Clyde Cameron, but still you do seem to have kept quite a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're a gigantic boon for historians. You know, let's face it, there is no substitute for contemporary evidence. And I mean, and diaries, you know, four, 40 people can go to a meeting, have a discussion, and then come out of it with each with differing accounts of it. You know, I've seen, particularly when I was a lawyer, I've seen, you know, examples of that. But when I say differing accounts, I mean honestly differing accounts. Mm. Mm. So, but having said that, history is made up of recollections and memories and records, and that's why it's important to pull them together. I might just add, Michelle, as you know, it's not as though people in politics have not, briefed out conversations with me, WhatsApp messages from me. I mean, I've read, you've seen them yourself. I'm not sure that you've written any of those stories, but you've seen plenty of occasions where things I've said or alleged to have said have been published. So, you know, there's some value in putting your name to it, as I have, it's my book, and actually telling the story as it happened. And, I mean, if people want to dispute that, they're free to do so. But no doubt will.
In the book, you seem to me to have a quite ambivalent attitude to Scott Morrison. You portray him as a leaker and one who used the media to try to lock colleagues in over policies, the so-called front-running technique. Yet you also thought that you had an effective working relationship as Prime Minister and Treasurer. Which is uppermost in your recollection now, the bad Scott or the good Scott?
Well, look, there's no bad or good Scott. There's just Scott, right? And he has strengths and weaknesses, as we all do. I did have a good working relationship with him. The only problem, quote-unquote, I had with Scott was his front-running of policy. And, he didn't deny it. Sometimes he blamed the particular things. He had no idea how they got into the media, but no one was particularly convinced by that. But, you know, Scott, it was a technique. He saw this as a way of front-running, floating ideas and policies in advance. And, you know, I it was completely antithetical to my approach. And I, as I said at the time, and as I've described in the book, you know, the problem with running your policy agenda through a series of hypothetical thought bubbles in the tabloid press or any press is that, you know, you run the risk that they get shot down in flames before you've formulated them. They can, you know, become, you know, run off like hares across the countryside and get out of control. And significantly, and this was the major problem that we had, we paid a high political price for this. People will, if you float half a dozen ideas in the media, and then, let's say, for perfectly good reasons, don't go ahead with them, you look as though you've backed off, walked away, reneged or something, and you maybe seem to have backed off or abandoned a policy that you were never likely to accept anyway. So as I say in one message to Matthias, you know, the approach that he and I had was that we should stick to whatever policy we have until such time as we decide to change it and then change it, as opposed to having policy A, but then tentatively floating that you might move to B, C or D. Look, there are people in Canberra who have defended Scott's approach, that they think that's a sensible way to proceed. I honestly don't. The most effective policy measures that we had, and the school's policy, you know, the so-called Gonski 2.0 is a very good example of this, where we did a lot of work in private, kicked around a lot of possibilities, went uphill and down dale on them, and then made a decision and then announced it. And, you know, and I don't have a problem with all of the options and the consideration that preceded the announcement being made public, at, you know, at some point, even, you know, relatively quickly. But the difficulty is that if you are literally thinking aloud, it honestly undermines effective government, in my opinion.
Do you think he's still front-running policy?
Oh, look, I'm not, I don't know. I couldn't, I'm not, you know, I'm not, you'd be better able to say that, Michelle. You're there in the gallery keeping an eye on things. You know, he's obviously got massive, completely unanticipated challenges to face at the moment. I think he's doing well with them, by the way. You know, I think the response of Australian governments generally has been a very effective one.
On the virus, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, there have been mistakes that have been made and, you know, they're feeling their way and no one really knows for sure what the right, you know, what right measures are and which measures are more effective than others. But collectively, the states and territories and the federal government have been doing a pretty good job and, you know, touch wood, let's hope that they continue to do so.
One of your main initiatives as Prime Minister was the legislation against foreign interference in response particularly to fears about Chinese interference. Do you feel that legislation is doing its job?
Well, I have heard, I've seen complaints that it is not being properly enforced and that in particular the transparency legislation, which was its, you know, there was a whole bundle of bits of legislation, but, you know, essentially there was one about foreign interference, which basically dealt with espionage and people trying to coerce others to, take particular approaches in terms of public policy and so forth. But then there's the transparency legislation, you know, which we talked about as foreign influence. Our position there was that we didn't mind if foreign governments or foreign state-owned companies or political parties wanted to seek to have influence in Australia, but they had to do so transparently, right? So it was essentially a, you know, sunshine policy. Now, there's been, I've seen, you know, people say that it hasn't been adequately enforced. Look, you know, in the face of a lot of controversy and criticism, I was able to ensure that those tools were created and it's really up to the government to make sure they use them.
But you're worried about that?
I wouldn't. I'm not. Well, I'm
concerned.
My concern is that Australia's democratic processes should be determined by Australians.
And you still think that threat is there?
Well, of course the threat is there.
Well, perhaps not being adequately met.
No, I'm not saying that, Michelle. That's what you're trying to get me to say. I'm really asking you, you're much closer to it, whether you think that is the case. I have seen people complaining and criticising whether it's being effectively implemented, but others would be better able to express a view on it. I mean, so there it is.
Now, you obviously have a lot of complaints about your treatment by News Corp, but more generally, do you think there needs to be reform of the media in Australia and what form should that take if you do?
Well, you know, we have a free press in Australia, but I think we have to recognise that News Corporation, and I think this, you know, this may well reflect Lachlan's influence because he is a much more right-wing person, much more ideological, political person than his father, which is saying something. But News Corp is, I think, was well described as a political organisation that employs a lot of journalists. I mean, it isn't, you know, the Australian is not, you can't compare the Australian, describe the Australian as a newspaper or the product of journalism. I mean, it defends its friends, it attacks its enemies, it attacks its friends' enemies, and the tabloids do the same. I mean, look at that leaving me aside, look at the extraordinary attack on Matt Keane. Remember when Matt Keane, the young environment minister, gave a perfectly fine, I would say mundane is not the right term, but it wasn't full of surprises. He gave a sensible speech about climate policy. And he was rewarded for that with the most vicious attack from the Daily Telegraph, claiming that he was, the personal attack, claiming that he was posing as a fire volunteer when he wasn't. And, it was just an classic tabloid hit. And, I don't think that News Corp any longer holds governments to account. And the question is, who is holding News Corp to account? This is the real challenge. It is operating as a political organisation, and the thing is that it isn't remotely any longer what you would call a proper newspaper. The Australian and the tabloids, they are basically political weapons. Of course, they still report news. They have to do that, but it's very much a political orientation. I mean, do you disagree with that?
Well, that's perhaps for another time.
Okay, so, well, Michelle, let me ask you this. Just as here's an important question for you. So, you've been in politics and journalism for a very long time. Why aren't you prepared to say what you think is going on in the Australian media? You're better able to talk about it than I am, probably.
Well, I think, as others might say, we'll take that as an observation rather than a question to be answered.
No, but seriously, this is an important question. What are you afeard of? I mean, you. Nobody has. But how long have you been in the press gallery? Is it 40 years?
Longer than I care to say, I think.
You have seen it. You've seen it. You would have started in the press gallery not long after the Australian was founded. As a newspaper. And so you've seen it all and you've seen how it's changed, but you're not prepared to have a discussion about it.
Perhaps not on this interview. Now, some of your enemies would like to see you expelled from the Liberal Party. Do you still see yourself as a loyal Liberal? It's a big L loyal Liberal. And what do you reply to those people?
Well, it would be ironic if the party of free speech expelled someone for writing a book. But I am a member of the Liberal Party and I'm proud to be so. I would be surprised if there would be much enthusiasm for expelling me from the party, but I'm not, when you consider the... way in which, I mean, what I've written is essentially an account of my life. It's essentially a work of history insofar it writes about politics. But when you consider the way some members of the Liberal Party savagely and often publicly sought to undermine and bring down my government, it is ironic that many of them are now supporting my expulsion from the Liberal Party. I'm puzzled why they didn't try to expel me from the Liberal Party when I was Prime Minister.
Where do you see the party heading in the next decade, and who do you see as those who can carry it forward successfully?
Well, as you know, the premise of a political party is a broad church, big tent political party. Is that you work by consensus. So that means that you'll have, people on the left and on the right and in the middle, and some people will be on the left on one issue, on the right on another, and, get a diversity of opinion. And the idea is that people debate these issues, they kick them around, and then the consensus or a majority, however you want to describe it, prevails. And that's the deal. Now, basically, the situation we're in with the Liberal Party is that the right, so I'm talking about Canberra in particular, the right are amplified and supported by their friends in the media, basically operate like terrorists. Now, I hasten to add, they're not using guns and bombs. It's a But their proposition is, if you don't do what we want, we will blow the joint up. And that was absolutely the way they operated in 2009, and they certainly the way they were operating during my prime ministership. I mean, there were, you know, the coup in August 2018 was not the first one. Remember, at the end of 2017, there was a whole move to use Christensen to, you know, when we had Barnaby and John Alexander out of the House and we didn't have a majority for a few weeks. Christensen was going to cross the floor and bring down the government unless I resigned as leader, and that was all being cooked up between Andrew Bolt and Peter Credlin. I mean, this is all public, you know, public knowledge. It's been reported on. And Christensen, for some reason or other, backed off it. But you had Jones inviting Kerry Stokes to his house at the end of 2017 with Abbott and saying, we've got to bring down Turnbull and so forth. So, you know, this was their agenda was to basically terrorise the party room, terrorise the government until they brought it down, in which case they would lose an election and Abbott would come back as opposition leader. This is the, you know, this is the scenario that Paul Whitaker at News Corporation, according to Murdoch, subscribed to, just staggering. And that's how they operated. But it was, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. And I mean, I hope, you know, that at some point you've got to say, you've got to describe the facts, Michelle, and the emperor has no clothes, say so.
Do you see any bright lights for the future in the party?
Well, I think if you mean bright lights individuals, yeah, there's lots of talented people there, sure. I think Josh Frydenberg is very good, young treasurer. I think Morrison's doing well. Look, Morrison and I are not, you know, we work together very productively. He had an approach to, you know, front-running policy which created real problems for us, and I think that damaged us. But I've said in the book, others would have a very different view, that I did not think he was doing it deliberately to damage the government. This was how he had this sort of strange relationship, particularly with News Corp, where he was always like bringing, you know, making them a kind of a collaborator in the development of policy through their pages, their newspapers. It was a bit bizarre. Anyway, so Morrison, well, he's at the top. I think you see a lot of smaller liberals in leadership positions in the states, you know, Gladys in New South Wales, Stephen Marshall in South Australia. I think that the challenge, though, is the way the right operates, that they have been able to succeed through this process of intimidation, and that will drive more moderate people out of the party, and so the minority can then become the majority. But it certainly means that the party is, you know, is operating, runs the risk of operating to the right of, you know, where the public is. This is a risk. I mean, you've seen this in the past, you know, where the Labor Party's membership and union leadership has gone too far to the left and got out of step with the public at large. I mean, look at the UK with Jeremy Corbyn. You know, he had overwhelming support of the British Labor Party. They loved it. And what happened? It was entirely predictable. you had a government that had been in complete disarray, and they had a landslide win, and you can't take any credit away from Boris Johnson, but boy, Corbyn made it very, very easy for him.
Now the book's done and dusted, will we hear the Turnbull voice in the big national debates of the coming years to a great extent?
Well, you will from time to time. Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not planning to run for Parliament again. I can assure you of that. But as I say, I'm just picking up my book, which I encourage your listeners to acquire legally. I say here, while I was determined to leave Parliament when my time as PM was over, I haven't lost interest in politics and public affairs. In particular, I remain committed to an Australian Republic and above all to seeing effective Australian and global action to cut our emissions and address global warming. Now that the 2019 election is over, I'm free to play a more active role in public life. I've surrendered the title of Prime Minister, but I retain the most important title in our democracy, an Australian citizen, with all of the responsibility and opportunity that entails.
And what about other plans?
Well, I mean, I'm in business. I mean, I'm not going to start another investment bank or anything like that. But I'm investing actively in a number of areas, but in particular in venture capital, and particularly in Australian technology. I mean, there've been announcements of my investment in Myriota, an Australian sort of small satellite company. I'm just dealing with the stuff that's publicly known. I've invested in Advanced Navigation, a leading Australian technology company in the area of virtualized gyroscopes that enable you to have essentially automated inertial navigation, which is, you know, very, in other words, navigation without using GPS or satellites. And there's a bunch of others. So, I'll continue doing that. That's what I used to do in the past. And I love being involved in technology and innovation. I think it's just such a big part of my political agenda, but it's a great passion of mine and so critical to Australia's prosperity and security in the years ahead.
It's been really good to talk to you, Malcolm Turnbull, but I just have one footnote question. I understand you've provided your own audio book reading. Does this include a return to your 2017 Midwinter Ball Trump impersonation?
Well, it wasn't really a Trump impersonation. Yes, well, it's a little. Well, you'll have to buy it and listen to it. Trump was very complimentary about it. It was quite funny. It was more of a Trumpian speech than a Trump impersonation. But I did enjoy that. It was the last so-called off the record Midwinter Ball speech, wasn't it? Because Laurie Oakes decided to publish someone's smartphone recorded version of it.
It's true that they're not so much fun on the record.
Oh, right. I'm told even Peter Credlin laughed when I gave that speech.
Malcolm Turnbull, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversation podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.